The book is literally called Jane Eyre. It's Jane's story. But I think so often people get distracted by how compelling of a character Rochester is. And of course we love him, but it's not his movie. And so if Jane can't carry Jane Eyre, then that is a mistake on the creator's part.
Exactly. If every time Timothy Dalton is not in the scene, I'm annoyed by the scene, it's a bad, they did a bad job.
Yeah, like, honestly. Well, Elian, I can't believe it, but we're kind of back where we started. How are you? How are you feeling about this?
I'm good. I've been here before. It's familiar territory. And honestly, so much better.
Oh my gosh, right? I am actually so excited to see how our thoughts kind of have changed, because I, on this watch through, definitely was more aware of things that I was not crazy about, because I think my rose-tinted glasses of how much I love the star kind of faded a little. I mean, I still love him, obviously, but everything else aside, I'm like, oh yeah, this would be a really rough way for me to bring Lillian into the story.
It was really, I was watching it and I was like, okay, I simultaneously understand why I hated this, and also why this is a good adaptation of Jane Eyre, because I now have we have so much more context than we did. So we haven't actually said we rewatched the 1983 miniseries of Jane Eyre by the BBC, starring one Timothy Dalton and Zela Clark. What a pleasant surprise for me specifically, because if you listened to our very first Pilot the Dog episode, wow, she wasn't thrilled to be part of this podcast now.
Which I'm so mad. I really was planning on re-listening to episode one before we recorded this, but I didn't get around to it. So once we're done, I will listen to that. I'm sure I will get quite a kick out of Lillian's begrudgment of agreeing to do a podcast of something that she at the time hated.
Here's the thing that I find particularly funny. Looking at our ratings, I can tell that we were both hedging just a scotch. So we watched it in two parts originally. And I very clearly was giving it a higher score than how I felt about it, because I was worried that I was being too much of a negative Nancy. And you very clearly, to me, gave it a lower score than you felt about it, because you were trying not to be too insanely, like, setting a bar too high for your sweet, sweet Timothy.
Just coming in hot, being like, it's a perfect 20 out of 10. You can all shut up about it.
I watch this every day for the rest of my life.
Prior to starting the recording today, we were kind of chatting like, okay, how can we, you know, differentiate this? Because it should not simply be a, okay, we're going to go again through all the scenes and be like, this is what I like, this is what I didn't like, blah, blah, blah. So I think that the best way to kind of approach this is to say, okay, so given what we thought at the beginning, let's compare it to what we think now, but then also let's compare it to how we've seen other versions take on this story. But I think most importantly, at least for me anyway, is kind of seeing how close of an adaptation this is to the book, and then how that works and how sometimes it doesn't work. That's kind of how I want to approach this.
I think I agree. A lot of the beats that I was like, this is wild the first time that I watched it, but now I'm like, okay, technically that is in the book, but you did not need that scene here. Like, that was unnecessary. So I think I completely agree. Do you want to know what our ratings were when we first watched it now?
Yes.
Or do you want to be surprised and we can recompare at the end?
No, tell me now. I want to have I want to put myself back in that mindset.
So we're zooming all the way back, so far back in time, listeners. Well, we watched it in December of 2021, but you guys heard us talk about Jane Eyre for the first time in January 2022, a full 11 months ago. I know, crazy times. And we watched, so we watched it in two parts, 1 through 7. And then 8 through 11. And I will tell you my ratings, and then I want you to guess your ratings. Okay. So for the first part, I rated it 5 out of 10.
That's very generous of you.
So generous of me.
Because I just remember how much you're like, this is just a bunch of sad childhood shit. I hate this.
I hated it so much. But I was like, you can't come in and be like, this is a 2 out of 10 and I hate this story and I kind of hate you for making me do this.
No, I loved you for making me do it. It was, I have such a blast making this podcast, but I thought it was going to be a very painful story and a very fun podcast. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, very happy to have been proven wrong about the podcast being fun. No, I'm just kidding.
Ouch.
So then episodes 8 through 11, I rated as 6 out of 10, which the end of episode 7, I believe, is the end of the wedding. Mm-hmm. That makes sense that those were the parts that I didn't really love so much. Mm-hmm. Now I want you to guess. So 1 through 7, what did you think you rated that?
1 through 7? Those episodes.
Yes, episodes.
Okay. I think I probably gave that one maybe a 7 out of 10.
You did. You gave it a 7 out of 10.
Nice. I think I probably, for the second half, gave it like an 8.5 out of 10.
Here's the thing. This was the most shocking thing I've ever looked up from past us. You rated the back half of 1983, Timothy Dalton, peak Jane Eyre, 5 out of 10.
Huh. I must have just really like disliked all of the St. John stuff.
All the St. John stuff brings it so far down.
I think I do remember us spending so much time talking about how much of a drag it is watching Jane literally go from house to house begging for food. And I think that really kind of like, I don't know, wore us down. But
yeah.
Yeah.
And I think maybe let's start at why St. John sucks. Because I would love, because I almost want to talk about like St. John part and then childhood part and then really dive into the part you and I. So you and I got together on Sunday and watched all of the like Jane and Rochester, like, core kissing parts.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, so nice.
We started literally at the scene where she meets him to the scene where he yells after she leaves. And so we quit halfway through 2 episodes.
Dude.
So what, like, that's all I want to watch with you.
Seriously. Most often when I do, I have been holding back because I knew that we were going to be doing this rewatch. But prior to that, when I am like, I'm in the mood to rewatch Timmy D's Jane Eyre, I don't watch the beginning. I don't watch the end. I just watch the middle parts. I just go in for what I want.
So here's why the St. John parts are so terrible. So first of all, Jane leaves. And I the thing that was like so jarring for me, I've talked about this before. I found it wild that she just like left and had no plan and paid all of her money to go on the carriage, like all this stuff. And I remember talking about that a lot. Mm-hmm. Here is when I watch it now, what I see, knowing the book and knowing they just missed so hard on the emotions of that scene.
Yeah.
She's doing all of the things that Jane does in the book, but with none of the feeling.
Yeah.
Where like Jane in the book has fully lost her mind. And this is a point of desperation. And I think we see that in like a 2011 with Mia Wachowski. Mm-hmm. Nope. That can't be right.
Our Mia though. We can just call her Mia.
Mia. Sure. So Mia does like an incredible job acting out that desperation, that like youthful, I just have to get out of here because I'm going to stay with this man if I don't leave. And I can't do that.
I also think that Mia's version, I was thinking of her version a lot in the rewatch of those sections, because I think what stood out to me so much from the book is how we talk about how Jane tries to live in nature and she can't. And I think the 2011 does this great job of having these moments of Jane offset against these like breathtaking moors that it is so beautiful and vast and yet so empty. And it's this idea where it's like you see that and visually I think it kind of awakens your soul. It nourishes your soul, but it cannot nourish her body, which is what she needs. And I think that was done so perfectly in 2011. So yes, to now go back and see this kind of, I mean, again, a lot of it is budget. This was a TV version in the 80s, but like that, none of that emphasis of the nature and that struggle from the book, that doesn't exist here.
Well, and the 2006, I will say, also really does that kind of comparison really well. The way they do it is a bit different in how they kind of cut it together. But I think they do that really well. And I think you hit the nail on the head of what I feel is missing in the next part as well. They go through the beats of Jane going to all these different places trying to get help. But they're way too focused on the way that she is begging for help from a society that is rejecting her because of their assumptions about who she is. And they completely miss the way that she's hiding in nature and how important that is for all these metaphoric things that we know about Jane.
Yeah.
And she doesn't, it's something that you and I talked about a lot in Zito's performance, or I'm just going to call her Clark because I know that that's how you pronounce her last name. And Clark, like Clark's whole performance is so sad.
Yes.
Like it's very tempered and sad. Mm-hmm. And knowing what I know now about the book, there are a handful of beats. We kept talking about this when we were watching it together. There's a couple of beats where she like gets there. Mm-hmm. She's really close to a good performance, but she misses so hard in things like when she's leaving. She just seems sad. Mm-hmm. She doesn't seem distraught. She doesn't seem passionate. Like she doesn't seem like fully lost as to who she is and what she's doing. Mm-hmm. The St. John things, she just seems like annoyed by him. Even when she's begging, like she doesn't quite hit that desperate note.
Yeah.
She just seems like sad and confused and incompetent.
Yeah. This is one thing that Lillian and I talked about a lot when we were watching together is Timmy D, easily my favorite Rochester, but Clark is not my favorite Jane by a mm-hmm. long shot. I have always noted from the beginning that I think, yeah, every time they just show her face, she just looks like a sad little dumpling that somebody kind of did a little moosh, and now she's just permanently stuck in this kind of sad, frowny face. And it's not her fault, of course. Well, I mean, she did do the performance, but... but I mean the way that she looks, it really stood out to me too, that you're right. A lot of the kind of the wit that we love so much, the banter that mm-hmm. we see when she goes toe to toe with a Rochester, that didn't seem like it was there quite so much. I think you're right. This version was definitely trying, I think, to focus on sort of the drama and the sadness a lot more than mm-hmm. others have maybe done. So yes, not my favorite Jane by far. And I think, yes, it shows up there. The other thing that I want to say mm-hmm. is I have felt this way, especially since reading the novel and uh-huh. getting the insight of Jane when she's in the drawing room, watching the fancy parties happening, making her judgments about Blanche. And then when also she's out begging and then is taken in. Jane as a character is someone I think who is rather snooty. She's a little like thinks high of herself. And I think that maybe a defense mechanism that she uses to kind of maybe distance herself from the like extreme sadness of her past and some other situations to be like, well, at least I got out of Lowood and at least I have an education and I'm not a poor random person. And it's something that really struck me in the 80 rewatch of this when she's again at the house with, is it Hannah? The housekeeper, yeah. She is, I hate this delivery in this line of her being like, she's like, I won't judge you because you called me a beggar, which was not okay of you to say of me. I'm better than that. And I'm like, Jane, you were literally begging at her door. You are a beggar. I'm just like, so I don't like her snootiness. Though I think it is accurate to Jane's character. I don't like that.
And I think accurate to Jane's character is so, it's so close. I think it's accurate to the lines, but I think that's what I felt. I think we see that some in other moments, but especially these last few episodes, even like when she comes back to Timmy, when Timothy Dalton's not there, mm-hmm. you can see how much he was carrying those moments yeah. when he was there.
Yeah.
Because they're playing out the words and the beats of the book, but missing the point. Mm-hmm. Like they're missing the point. They're missing the point of that conversation, because I do disagree with some of the ways that Charlotte's saying that mm-hmm. in those moments and the point that Bronte is making. Mm-hmm. But I don't disagree. I think they're not even making her point. Like her point is a commentary on like, if I was a beggar, you shouldn't have treated me that way. And I'm not a beggar. So that's like another layer of anybody can be misunderstood in those moments. And like, you don't really know somebody's story and what's going on and all this other stuff. And like in the book, you can feel those layers of complexity of that moment and the relationship that Hannah has with St. John and mm-hmm. Jane has with like society in general. And it's because it's all set against this comparison of society and nature and like all these other philosophical things,
yeah.
which I think is part of the reason why it's so often skipped in adaptions is that's hard.
It's really hard to portray that in a good way. And it really makes me think too, I love now having like all of these like examples mm-hmm. and things to pull from, because one thing that also stood out to me that we talked a lot about when we were reading the novel is in the beginning, when after Jane has her kind of like freak out moment and the doctor comes to see her and he has this conversation with her about, he's like, well, like if you could go away from this nice house where you are cared for, would you want to, even if you like didn't have these things anymore, mm-hmm. but it meant being away from these people. And she has that moment of reflection of, she's like, all I knew of poverty was that it was like this thing to be feared or frowned upon. And she's like, I would rather stay here and suffer with these awful people than go mm-hmm. and be like an impoverished person on my own, which she then yeah. later, that happens to her. She becomes mm-hmm. that. And I think that's maybe something that I'm trying to think of the right words to use. When she is kind of like defensive about her position towards Hannah, of her being like, I'm not yeah. a beggar. I think it's because she's like, shit, I was literally a kid and I said I yeah. didn't want to do this and here I am. And so I think it's her kind of being like, no, that's not me. I haven't fallen to that.
Yeah, I think if we were going to put modern language to it, it'd be like internalized classism.
Yeah.
It's like she thinks that bad people are poor because mm-hmm. that's the way that she was taught bad people are.
Yeah.
And so she's trying, even while defending poor people and while being literally destitute, mm-hmm. she is still trying to distance herself
yeah.
from what is considered a bad person in her mind
yeah.
through this and poverty.
I think it really is Bronte's like writing that is responsible for this, maybe her viewpoints. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's this whole thing there when they're all like justifying why it's good for them to help her because she looks like she's a lady and she came mm-hmm. from something
it's
better.
So gross.
And it's like, no, you guys, like you're not doing this because you actually care. You're doing it because it's the Christian right thing to do. And that's not a good reason.
Which like they don't. I think what's hard in watching this is that is the conversation that happens. Like the whole Christian ideal thing is the conversation that happens in the book. Mm-hmm. But what this misses so hard on is it has the conversation, but it says the words of the conversation. It's not doing the dissection of those ideals.
Right.
In the way that the book does. Another beat that I just want to reference a comparison to, and then I actually think looping back to the childhood and then we'll get into the good stuff. I think because we just obviously talked about 73, we talked a lot about specifically Michael J. Stone's performance. I think that Jane in the 73, whose name I am forgetting and I apologize, incredible Jane. Mm-hmm. Like she's part of why I like his performance so much is mm-hmm. how well they play off of each other and the chemistry that they have.
Yeah.
But I also think the way they chose to pace that out mm-hmm. was so much better. That this I notoriously hate all the St. John parts because I would like to kill St. John. The fictional character, I don't want to kill any real people, guys. But they end one of the episodes with the carriage pulling up and she's going to get on the carriage. They don't do the whole conversation, all this stuff. Like she runs away. We see her getting on a carriage mm-hmm. and then it cuts to her being arguably the most disheveled Jane. We get a lot of really disheveled Janes. Ruth Wilson was a very disheveled Jane.
Yes.
In the 73, she's very disheveled. She's outside the store. So you can tell something terrible has happened, but we don't watch her go begging. We don't watch her in nature. And if you don't have the ability to truly set up those scenes mm-hmm. and really have that conversation,
yeah.
I think that's a really good way to cut to like, something happened. It was bad. She had a rough time. And now she's actively begging at this house.
Oh, totally. I agree with you. I think one of this movie's or the show's kind of like weaker elements is, yes, pacing mm-hmm. is not done super well.
It's brutal.
I remember you talked about that a lot in our first watch through of having to watch her specifically walk through the room to go to the piano and everything. I wonder if, because again, I feel like this felt very like a stage production. I felt like mm-hmm. kind of the people working on it had maybe they were familiar with a theater version of this and that's kind of how they treated it. So I don't think it didn't feel like it was adapted to screen as well as it could have been. Mm-hmm. Because I think a lot of those moments where if you're sitting in a theater and watching this happen, then of course you're going to watch her walk across the stage to go to the piano and everything. So
I think that's such an interesting point because it makes a lot of the, like the fact that she's not in the nature, she's going house to house. A couple other beats that drove me full nuts is like, they have her have that full conversation with the lawyer. And I'm like, why would you include that? That's so unnecessary.
Yeah.
And just like all these other things that I'm like, I know this is in the book. You're doing it bad and boring.
Though, okay. So before we jump to childhood, one thing that this version does that I am obsessed with that no other version has done, the closest we get is in 2011 when she has a dream about Rochester, is that after she leaves, we get to see Rochester briefly again at Thornfield. And yes. It's, in my like little romantic opinion, such a great scene. We see how like he still has like this like kind of anger and this like brokenhearted devastation from before when she left in that proposal. But now he's using it and his resources to get Mr. Briggs, the solicitor, to like rally essentially a horde of lawyers across the lands to try and find where Jane is. And I love that previously, I think in the novel, it's simply referenced by St. John that like advertisements have gone out of like trying to find where Jane is, which we discussed in that book section. I said Rochester did that. You said you thought it was the uncle. Here,
I still think it's the uncle. I think it's the 83 is reinterpreting that as Rochester doing it.
We'll have to go back and read the lines carefully. I do think it was Rochester who put out that advertisement trying to find his Jane, his little elf. But I love that we get that scene. No, but I just love that we got to see him again. We got to see him actively trying to find her. And I think his sentiment there, because he says, he's like, I'm not going to hunt her. He's like, if I find out where she is, I will do my best to not go after her, which obviously if he did find out, he would go to her. But it's just him being like, just wanting to, we get to see what we love about Rochester is him being that caregiver. He's like, I just want to make sure that she's not destitute. I want to just provide for her and make sure that she's okay out there in the cruel world that I hate so much. And so I love that we got that moment in this. It's so nice.
I also think even if I'm correct and my interpretation of that beat where I believe that it's not Rochester searching for her, it's the uncle. I think something that is true to the book is in the book at the very end, when Jane comes back, he goes, you're not dead in the ditch somewhere. Mm-hmm. Like you're not dead. Like he thinks she's dead. And I think that's a beat where like that's not a bad fear. Like she almost died leaving him.
Totally.
This is the only scene that feels like a big departure from the book. Mm-hmm. Not in this like semantic way we're talking about, but in actual like plot points.
Yeah.
But I think it has that element of truth that we talk about in departures from the book that still hold true to who these characters are.
Absolutely. And I kind of said this like just now, and it made me think about it in closer detail when I said that he wants to make sure that she's provided for now that she's run out into this world that he like says that he despises. We kind of see that, I mean, as she goes around, like we've just talked about, looking for like care and assistance, and everyone turns her away. And I think that is part of that society thing that Rochester sees and despises. He's like, people out there claim to be good, but they're not good. They're following their dumb rules and they're not going to help my sweet Jane. He's like, I would help her. Like, he loves her. So of course he would. But I just like that kind of comparison, expansion of this kind of previous theme that we've discussed.
So Child Jane.
How do you like this actress's performance upon second viewing?
What a intense little lady.
She's very intense.
I don't think it's bad, but I think, and this is something I'm going to talk about a lot with Dalton's performance as well. Mm-hmm. I think it is a particular choice in how to interpret what Child Jane is. Mm-hmm. I think something that I've talked about, I don't think any adaptation has done particularly well, that this one also misses on, is that moment where the book begins is such a moment of change. Mm-hmm. And because they don't do a good job of establishing how Jane was immediately prior to that, not justified in that like adults should ever treat any child like this, but you see why they're treating, like, it feels more like they're, as opposed to her behavior being a reaction to their treatment, it feels like their treatment is a reaction to her behavior. Mm-hmm. And that is just the opposite of what's happening.
You're saying because Jane is so like defiant and outspoken, the family is cruel to her because they don't like that about her. That's how you would interpret that. Interesting. Okay.
I think in the book, she has been treated like she's defiant and outspoken, despite the fact that she's been trying to be their definition of good. Mm-hmm. And no amount of good that she is has ever been helped her be successful in that. So she has just decided to let her fire and passion to the surface and be honest and tell these people that they can go fuck themselves because they're being so unacceptable to her. And she's just going to tell them what she really thinks. Mm-hmm. I think in this adaptation, it captures the second part, but not the first part. Mm-hmm.
And we know, I think that this is terrible and unacceptable, and there's no justification for the way these people are treating her. But I think that it makes it look like she's this defiant child. And so they're abusing her in an attempt to get her to be less defiant instead of it being the other way around. Like, her defiance in the book is a response to their abuse.
Yeah.
And in this adaption, it feels like the abuse is a response to her defiance.
I can see how that is, like, the interpretation. I don't think I personally see it that way myself, but I see what you're saying. I think my solution to that critique would be that they take this already very long section of their miniseries and make it even longer by being like, okay, well, let's open with moments of her trying to, like, be part of this family. But we already have so much of this, and we just want to get to Timmy D.
If they, honest to God, if they just cut out the children walking around.
Yeah.
Like, if they, it's the bizarre pacing of this, which I think if you talk about it the way you do, as like it's a play, mm-hmm. it makes a little bit more sense mm-hmm. that, like, well, that actor has to get from that side of the stage to that side of the stage. I have some great news about cameras. There's this thing you can do. It's like, it's harder when it's film. Digitally, I will admit it's a little bit easier because even I can do it and I'm a dumb dummy. You can just, like, cut parts out.
Oh, crazy.
We don't have to watch them walk across the set. Mm-hmm. We don't have to watch Madeline's two rows of two girls walking down the street for an hour. We don't have to watch 7,000 coffins come out of this building.
7,000 coffins, I wish.
But then skip Helen's death?
I know. I can't believe they skip Helen's death. That is such a freaking crime. For
so bizarre.
A version that takes, like, is rather close to the book, takes so much time in establishing the sadness of Lowood, but then takes away what makes Jane go from this little hothead, who I kind of love her energy. I love a good, like, hotheaded Jane. And this one, we definitely see her delivering the lines, you know, where she's like, yeah, if she hit me with that stick, I would break it under her nose. And Helen's like, probably you wouldn't do that. And if you did, you'd be expelled. So shut up. But, like, so I love her kind of like, grr. Like, she did include the line, by the way, which I do love in the book, where she says, she's like, like, people who are cruel to us, they must be, like, put down or corrected, because otherwise they will just keep going. They're never going to learn. Your kindness lesson isn't going to work. And I love that we do see that from her, because then later, of course, she learns from Helen. She takes on that stuff and she becomes kind of like, oh, I will, like, turn the other cheek kind of a thing. But yeah, how dare they not have Helen's death scene? Because that is so crucial.
Yeah, this Helen is super weak.
Yeah.
Like, and I mean that not in, like, because Helen's character we could have a whole conversation about, but I mean, like, the way they portray the character, they did a poor job of that. I will say, I think this is my favorite Miss Temple.
Yes.
Which makes sense why I was always, like, waiting for her in other adaptations. I was like, where's Miss Temple? She was always so nice. I liked her. I think this Miss Temple is really, really great in a way that Helen is just, like, not.
And this version clearly, I think, made Miss Temple the main person in young Jane's life to inspire Jane to be a good and, like, better person, quote unquote. And so it is a kind of a situation we've talked about before, other adaptions, giving the roles, the influential roles of other characters in the book to different people in the movies or the shows. So at least here, it's not like a random guy that, like, you know, is the one who helps put her on her path. But yeah, the fact that I think they put the weight of that responsibility on Miss Temple's shoulders.
Yeah.
Less so than Helen.
And I think it's a miss, but I get it.
Yeah.
But they also, if they truly had, like, a lean child, like, if they had the childhood was, like, trimmed down and they were hitting the beats and they were just getting the emotional parts in and they chose to cut out Helen's death scene, I would be like, that's a bad choice, but I get it. You didn't do that.
We had to watch kids get beat with sticks and, like, still we did not know Helen's death, so.
You did, like, super long, let's wash an ice scene, but we can't watch Helen die? What the hell?
I just want to see a child die. Jesus.
Is it too much to ask to watch a child die slowly of a cough?
Oh my God. Amazing. So yeah, weird choice with that one. Should we talk about Timmy D and Clark's interactions together and that main middle chunk?
No, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know why that would be an important part. I think we did it. We've covered all the...
Dude.
No. Yes. Okay. Let's start where you and I started on Sunday.
Dude.
She's walking in the woods. There's a man on a horse.
Oh my God. And he is like kind of gruff, but not like mad at her. I think we both said when we were watching that scene, we're like, yep, this one falls into the situation where he's not just like screaming at this lady. He's simply just kind of like, God, I fell off my horse and I'm embarrassed. And who's this person? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But yeah, dude, for me, wow, what a great way to meet this guy.
I think that's one of many scenes and one of many beats that we'll talk about where Timmy D did it and Clark did not.
Yes.
Because he falls off of his horse and she, and I think this is where it's like, it's a little bit hurt. It's also the story they're choosing to tell because they don't give her enough space to do anything. Like,
yeah.
It is super important in that moment that Jane is helping Rochester. This is a moment where Rochester is using Jane to help him.
Yeah.
Like the person pushing that scene forward is Rochester saying, come here, I will make use of you, as opposed to Jane being like, I can't possibly leave you like this, sir. Like, and him being like forced to figure out, like, to be like, okay, get me my horse. Like, there's none of that, which again, that's a moment where it's like, well, arguably timing, but you've done such a shitty job with timing. We watch her walk down the street for a long time before that.
Yeah. No, one thing that became very clear to me from this watch through. So I said already, yes, Timmy D, great. Clark, eh. And actually, so just before this, you had sent me a comment from someone on YouTube, and they were doing mostly a like, hooray, Michael Jayston, and then comparing other things. But they made a point that I actually kind of agree with about Timmy D's performance. I feel like when he's in a scene with somebody, he kind of tends to dominate. And it's sort of, and I don't know if this was the direction or just simply how other actors kind of, when they see him kind of, you know, take over the scene, they just sort of step back and they're like, we're just going to let him carry this. This is his moment. And that felt very clear to me too, where it does feel like so often he is there to do his incredible reading of this character and these beautiful lines straight from the book and to give that bravitas. And I think everyone else is there to simply kind of be the trim around him. That's kind of what it felt like.
And I think that's where it will, unless we get a chance to talk to, I honestly wouldn't feel comfy interviewing Clark at this point because we've said such mean things about him. Like the director or the screenwriter or something, like it is whatever it was. If Jane had met his energy, if he had had a scene partner who, when he came in and took up the energy of the room, also elevated and met him at that space, and everyone else in the room seemed dim because these two were so much, that would have been incredible. Like, that's really what's so disappointing of this, is if we had had one of our really great Janes that we've had up against Timothy Dalton instead of this, like, really close.
Yeah.
Like, you're not... I don't feel like saying Clark's a bad actress. I haven't seen her in literally anything else. I think this is a bad performance, and I don't know who that really sits on.
Yeah.
But I, in like in Beats by the Fireplace and other moments, like, she just looks sad, and in her looking sad, it makes his excellent performance look mean.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something that we've talked about. And I remember Charlene is the woman who does Air Files, right?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. I remember in your interview with her from Care So Much, other great podcast that Lillian has, go check it out. She talked about something that we've also touched on, is this idea where the book is literally called Jane Eyre. It's Jane's story. But I think so often people get distracted by how compelling of a character Rochester is. And of course we love him, but it's not his movie. And so if Jane can't carry Jane Eyre, then that is a mistake on the creator's part.
Exactly. If every time Timothy Dalton is not in the scene, I'm annoyed by the scene, it's a bad, they did a bad job.
Yeah, like, honestly.
I'm sorry.
Are we blowing, like, our listeners' minds right now? Like, shitting on
you
this?
You guys are like, no, I love the idea of, I love the idea of our listeners sitting there being like, hold on, Jane Eyre is about Jane.
Like, wait a second.
Everything about my life is different. No, I think, I think there's another beat that you and I talk about all the time that I think is really reflective of this. Because I think we see that in those fireplace conversations. I think we see it in the meeting. I think it's so close in the proposal to being so incredible.
I still love that scene. That one still does it for me. And I'll go into why. But
well, and we'll talk. So I think let's there's three beats to the way they set up this proposal scene. Mm-hmm. They start in the house in like the sitting room area. Mm-hmm. And then Jane runs out of the sitting room into the garden. Mm-hmm. And then they sit on the benches in the garden. And then there's a second emotional buildup. Mm-hmm. And then Dalton like comes across and grabs her arms. And like, so I like the sitting room part. And I like the grabbing her part. And I truly hate the him sitting on a bench being mean to her while she cries in the corner.
That part was definitely an odd decision. I don't like that they started it in the library, because that's one thing that Lily and I talked about when we were watching this live, is it kind of ruins it when he has now already seen how upset she is. When she says, away from Thornfield, away from you, sir, and then runs out of the room, that is the confession that he has been looking for. At least the way that she delivered it and the way that she exited that room. That should say to anybody, this woman loves you. There's your proof. So the fact then, yes, that they then go out to the garden and he keeps doing the kind of like teasing her to admit even more than that, that is not played well. I agree completely. I think one thing that I do really love about that proposal scene for me, though, is that scene, I think, is the first time where Clark really starts to show the kind of passion and emotion of adult Jane that we haven't seen before. Where everything else, yes, she's still very sad sitting here. We said when we watched this together, they're really playing it as like a kind of unrequited love thing for Jane. Mm-hmm. She does not realize that this man, she's an idiot. She should, it's very obvious. But for whatever reason, she does not realize that this man truly loves her. And he's doing all of this to like make this happen for them. And so that sadness for her of being like, I love you so dearly and you are going to marry this other woman and send me away and I can't stand it anymore. And I think she has, it builds up until it breaks and we get to see a bit of that kind of anger and passion of little Jane again. Mm-hmm. And I do really love how she pushes him back. Once he pushes her too far, I love Clark's way that she reads the lines of when he like is like, okay, marry me. And she's like, you play a farce with me. And he's like, you don't believe me, Jane? She's like, not a whit. And I just love all of that. I'm like, yeah, give it back to him. He shouldn't have treated you this way, but now you can kiss. So I like all of that. That works for me.
I think I completely agree. And I really think what it comes down to is because of where Dalton's performance is, because I agree with what you said about like, she's an idiot if she doesn't understand that this man is in love with her.
Look at how he stares at her through the shadows.
That could be a way that you could misinterpret Jane Eyre in general. Is like, how does Jane, Rochester is so clearly in love with her. How does Jane not know that? Mm-hmm. I think in like a 73 where they're both doing this bantery thing, and Jason's performance is so subtle about how much he's like in love with her, but we can tell, but I can understand how if you have Jane's perspective, you would miss that. I think that that's where that is. I'm not saying Dalton's interpretation is wrong by being this more melodramatic, intense version of it, but when you pair it with a less dramatic Jane, it makes it harder. If she was being really melodramatic as well, then it's just like, well, this is just how people are. People are just melodramatic about things. It doesn't mean he loves me. Like that's the part that I think is like really makes it so that it's like, okay, so she doesn't know this man who is obviously in love with her is in love with her. Mm-hmm. And then he can tell what, as soon as she starts to, because it makes more sense that he doesn't realize that she's in love with him.
Right.
Which is why if they had cut the beats in the library because they wait to deliver Rochester's best line until they're in the garden. Like his like string line and all that good stuff, like that they wait for that in the garden. It's again the pacing of the way they put that scene. She shouldn't emotionally break until he's ready to stand up and hold her and tell her he loves her.
Yeah.
And then I think like that moment afterwards, I think is one of the best of like him. And you talk about this all the time, the height difference between like, if all they did was cast her for her height, then like, guys, come on. But like the height difference of him standing over and holding her, I think is one of the reasons why he can't be quite so intense. Like the I think a Fassbender, for example, really like grabs her. The height difference, that would make it so scary.
Yes, it would be way scarier if Timmy is like grabbing someone's face and be like, oh my gosh, she's gonna die.
She's the size of a thimble and he's an actual giant.
No, that's a good read. That's a good point.
So I think that that's where I just think it's sad that it misses, because I completely agree. Some of his readings of those lines is incredible, mm-hmm. but he's delivering it to a crying cutout
yeah.
of a person.
So I had a theory pop into my head when we were kind of discussing this while we were watching mm-hmm. together. And this is not a justification. I think it's if we wanted to try and put like a little like, oh, well, maybe this is an okay thing, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. What you just said about Jane being a crying cardboard cutout, there's yeah. a thing that is done. I don't know if it's always intentional, where the main character is meant to be kind of like average and bland so that the audience can like cast themselves into the role, essentially. So like, I personally view Harry Potter sometimes is portrayed as like, he's just kind of a whatever guy, but he's surrounded by incredibly talented people and mm-hmm. they help him do things. And like, there's other like Mary Janes and Mary Sues and other things like that, where it's like, well, kind of like Bella Swan, for example, she's kind of like, yeah. oh, she's so clumsy and average, just like me. Maybe Edward's in love with me, actually. And so like, I don't like when they do that, whether it's intentional or not. But I yeah. think that might be something too, where it's just sort of like, oh, like I could easily step into this lady's role and also do nothing. And he would still be talking to me in that dramatic way. So awesome.
Yeah, I think That very well could be a choice they're making. If so, they deeply misinterpreted Jane Eyre.
Yes, not what she is meant for. She is not like other girls, guys.
She's not like the other girls. Jane is special. I think that I want to kind of skip over the wedding because I don't think we have anything unique to say about that.
Nah.
But let's talk about the make or break. Mm-hmm. I would say Dalton is definitely one of the top two or threes of delivering that stay speech.
Yeah.
First, he trips her as she walks out the door.
And then uses his incredible height to like nuzzle her and lean over her. And it's like, holy
honestly,
hell.
The sexiest Jane Eyre scene.
Ooh, I mean, wait. I would think you would actually say that Stephen's making out and kissing upon Ruth
so
Wilson
true.
Is the sexiest.
That's the sexiest.
That's easily the sexiest. This one is number two.
I would say it's number two, and it's without breaking Jane Eyre.
Yes, yes. I remember when we reviewed this the first time, is that mm-hmm. I think you said the first time that you actually thought that you liked him and stuff is when he started to be mm-hmm. vulnerable at the end of that.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that Timothy Dalton does amazingly well. Obviously, we've seen Rochester's with that element of desperation, but I think his range. I think, again, this feels like such a theater performance. I think if he hasn't done this on stage, he should. I mean, now he's too old, but like, just the way that he can go from that it's a roller coaster ride, this scene of him being like, you know, he's like, oh no, I'm going to send Adele to school. It's all taken care of. Like thinking like, oh, I can maybe salvage this to him being like, no, you can't leave me, and starting to go through like the bartering and everything like that, to then his like breakdown and his tears. I love that we actually see him cry that way. It's one of the more kind of broken, vulnerable Rochesters mm-hmm. we've seen, I think. So I really like the whole thing.
I completely agree with you. I think they hit all the beats so well. And specifically, there's moments where Clark does a good job mm-hmm. in this. Like, but there's critical moments where she doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the way that he goes from like this caretaker who we love, of like realizing that Jane, like he's sitting outside her room waiting for her, realizing that Jane's not okay, like carrying her down the stairs, getting her set up in a chair, getting her some wine and sitting down next to her. And this sort of delusional mania that he plays, which at the time I thought of when I first watched it, I remember thinking like, what an arrogant ass that he thinks that she's still going to be with him. And now I can see the subtleties in that moment of this. It's not him. It's him deluding himself. Mm-hmm. It's him like actively misunderstanding the situation because the reality of it will break him.
Yeah.
And then his desperate pleas and the ways he like kneels down in front of her and like, God, we were constantly joking about how often this Rochester ruins Jane's hair.
Yes. He's like, oh, shh, just smearing it across her face.
She'll never know that it looked bad. She's not going to know till the very end of the day.
Oh,
anyway.
Boy.
But so the way that he like uses her sitting in this chair, that's his chair, and like walking around the room, and the way he uses body language is incredible. The turn is so critical and so well done in this, mm-hmm. of this like, you see the emotion building behind it in this very frantic, manic way. Mm-hmm. And then you see that vulnerability, and the reason for this manic behavior is like, if this is really it, if there's no way to fix it, if all of these ideas are not going to work, I don't know how to live anymore.
Yeah.
Jane.
Right. Like, I think one of my favorite lines that he delivers that I also love from the book is when he, you know, starts asking her, he's like, how do you expect me to like go on without you? Mm-hmm. Like, how am I going to like go one way and you go another? And she's like, you'll do as I do, like suffer through it and turn to God or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I love at the very end, we get her thing of saying where she kind of sees how much he's distraught and she turns back to give like one last farewell. And she says something along the lines of like, you know, God, like keep you and reward you for your kindness towards me. Mm-hmm. And he comes back with this, like, your love would have been my like best reward. And it's like, oh my gosh. Like, oh, how could you leave him like that? Like, I need that. I need the perfect emotion of that moment in this version to end in a George C. Scott thing where she's like, I'll just stay the night. And once he like cries himself to sleep, then she slips out the back.
Well, and I think that's where like the way she delivers those lines is like a calm person giving a prayer instead of devastated, broken, also crazy. Mm-hmm. And that's what leads into the miss of her calmly putting away pearls, calmly packing up her stuff, calmly going on and getting a carriage, and then doing the dumbest shit I've ever seen. Like, if she had played that really like insane, as if she had been devastated by the fact, she needs to be devastated that she's leaving him.
Yeah.
Equal to his devastation. Like, his devastation is played so well. Mm-hmm. And it seems manipulative in moments because she's not reacting back.
Right. No, Lillian, I agree with you 1000% that if he had someone opposite him who was doing the same level of like dramatic acting, it would have killed. It would have been absolutely phenomenal. So I completely agree. Yeah.
Any other final thoughts before we do our second rating, first time rating the entire piece?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered everything that I needed to say. He's hot. I want to print off pictures of him in the school library, cut them out and tape them into the inside of my locker.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think you should do that. I don't think anybody's going to stop you. Sorry. I'm just having flashbacks of my locker decorated in high school with like cutouts of Edward Cullen and
Zac Efron.
Jacob Black's little face.
Cute.
And Zac Efron, decorated by our good friend Maya.
Yes.
Me eating an apple between them. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes.
Somebody took a picture of me in the hallway at lunch once eating an apple.
Oh my
and
God.
My friends printed that out and put it in my locker between Robert Pattinson and Taylor Lautner.
It's amazing. Oh, dude. I used to go so hard. That was like my favorite thing about like going back to school. It's like, ooh, I get to like print out all my crushes and decorate my locker and my binders.
What a choice. What a choice that we as teenagers are wild.
Yes.
Like, no one can see how I really feel because that's embarrassing. But I am going to put the people that I am claiming to be attracted to on my locker as a statement of who I am.
Right. Exactly. It's like, oh, this. It's just this guy from this movie that I really like. I know everything about him.
Well, and it's like mine was making a particular statement of like, I'm also very mainstream and honestly kind of basic. And like yours was like, I'm into like weird old dudes.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, this is Tim Curry who's dressed up like a devil because one time he seduced this little lady and I want to be that lady because for whatever reason I find this really hot. I'm 15. So bizarre.
So you now, as an adult woman,
yes.
What are you rating this adaption overall with all these things that we've taken into account?
This is really hard for me. I'm honestly stuck between overall, I kind of want to say a 7.5, but my love of Dalton wants it to be an 8. How about a 7.8?
Ooh, this is the most granular our ratings have ever gotten.
Yeah, because I don't know, he is the best, but I think I do have to stand by what we've said, that this is not Rochester. This is Jane mm-hmm. Eyre. That's what this is.
Yeah.
And they kind of miss that in this performance. So I think I have to give this a 7.8, and I'm going to give it Timmy D's. I got to stick with my staple. 7.8 Timmy D's.
I think he's where we start. Mm-hmm. I feel very similar. This is probably the most conflicted about a rating I've been. Mm-hmm. Because in rewatching it, I am appreciating Dalton's performance so much more. Mm-hmm. And I'm understanding why it was such a, and I apologize, this is not a burn on past Piper, but like such a poor introduction to the story for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think overall, if I set Dalton's performance aside, mm-hmm. I would put this at like a 4 or a 5.
Yeah.
Like not great. But if I was rating Dalton's performance separately, I would give it an 8 or a 9.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, I'm setting my overall rating at a 7.
Nice. Cool. What's your mode of ranking?
This does something we didn't talk about because it was most of what I talked about in the first one is Pilot is still great in this.
Yeah, he's actually a fluffy Newfoundland just like he is in the book. They did that correctly.
Oh, and also, you know, I've picked my rating, but it makes me remember one last note that I have on this. Costuming is great in this,
mm-hmm.
specifically. If you're wondering where Bonnet Watch comes from, it comes, this is the adaptation to hold all bonnets against.
Yes.
So many bonnets that are making so many statements.
Amazing. So good.
So it's, this is 7 out of 10 bonnets.
Very nice. I also want to say, so when you asked earlier, what is my final note? I'm going to go off of what you just said about costuming because I mean, it's partially just me like objectifying this man, but his outfits are so hot. He's got so many good cravats and his vests and just his powder blue wedding suit. Very 80s. So cute. And when we see him at the end and he's got his cool edgy scar and his edgy mullet and his edgy stub, he's also Mr. like very tall, dark and handsome in his dark clothes. And I'm like, ooh, hi. You hottie McHotterson.
when Piper said that, I started freaking out because I almost forgot to mention the best thing she said while we were watching.
Yes.
Which is, I went, he's wearing like 3 vests. And Piper's response was, he's a present for me to unwrap.
Yes, exactly. I think honestly, if we're gonna do, this is a side episode for our next podcast where we're just obsessing over period dramas. But there's something about like wearing a lot of clothes with the idea that, ooh, you have to get through all of that. That's kind of hot. I think. I don't know. We can unpack that at my next therapy session. That's but
like the week, and unpack that. Like I'm your therapist.
Yeah, obviously, I paid Lillian to tell me that I'm not crazy.
And nobody is to correct that.
Says the woman, I pay the woman who constantly every single episode says that she herself is insane.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, that was beautiful and wonderful. And we could genuinely talk about specifically this adaption for 7 more years. If you missed those first episodes, because they were our very first 2 episodes, go back and I think this will add some cool new context for you. But I have a couple of exciting things to share with you guys. First of all, next week we are going to be doing the long discussed Bertha episode. So we are going to be talking about Bertha Antoinetta Mason Rochester.
The one and only.
Has been embodied by so many people, including but not limited to me, because I was her for Halloween. Check out our Instagram for that. So we're going to talk about her as a character, her different representations in the adaptions, and a bunch of other cool things. So tune in for that, including a little surprise clip that we're going to end on a light note. And that's the little teaser I'll leave you guys with for this one.
Hooray.
The next episode is one that I didn't put in my notes, but just after that, we are going to be doing a palate cleanser and we're going to be doing a Christmas movie. And I'm mentioning that now because we're going to put a little poll up. So that's going to go up at the end of this week. So it's actually going to be done before our next episode, which is why I'm mentioning it now.
Mm-hmm.
So our options for that to think about when you're, so you can be ready to vote is A Christmas Carol. There's an 84 version of that that has one George C. Scott.
Hooray!
Then we have the Christmas episode of Downton Abbey from 2011.
Yay.
Meet Me in St. Louis from 1944. Mm-hmm. And then just a totally other random one that's Last Holiday from 2014.
Yay!
Which is just a great movie that I would love to watch. So get your votes in and we're going to watch a cozy little Christmas movie and talk about it for our palate cleanser.
Absolutely. Can't wait to see what you guys pick.
Yay! All right. Well, that's everything that I have for this episode. If you really enjoyed us talking about Timothy Dalton and you also would like to unwrap him for Christmas.
Yes, please.
Please mention that the reason you're giving us a 5-star rating is because you want to unwrap Timmy Dalton. Like, put that out there.
And then no other context. Yeah, that should be the entire review, please. And thank you.
Timothy Dalton is a present. Should be your review.
Yes.
Please. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We would love to hear your thoughts. You can also obviously recommend this podcast to your friends and family. Join us in our madness as we dive even deeper into this incredible story. And follow us on all of our social. We are at Airbuds, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Lillian has been doing some awesome video editing. So if you're someone who likes to visualize and not have to use your imagination, but actually just watch stuff, YouTube. And Lillian makes videos on YouTube.
Join me while I learn more about copyright and fight the internet to be like, no, I swear it's fair use for real, guys.
So check all of that out. And we hope that you will tune in next week. Thank you guys so much for joining us. We love you. Happy Jane Eyre reading and watching.
Bye.
Bye.